Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington, and today we're interviewing J.L. Collins, and we're going to talk mini retirements, but I invited my good friend Jillian Johnsrud to chat with me today. So Jillian, how's it going today?
So good. Yeah, excited for this.
And behind the scenes, we have recorded several times and chatted for hours over the past 2 weeks. So
we're basically best friends now.
It's been good to like see outside of like conferences and stuff and really catch up. And yes, best friends now. So I was checking out your bio. You're a writer, speaker, coach, and more. You're over at retireoften.com. And what else do you do? Can you just give like a 1 minute intro? Like, what's your story if people don't know you?
What I do, I garden, I do tango, I walk, I travel, I have cool friends. My story, me and my former spouse, we started with like $55,000 of debt and we never earned a ton of money. Like, we weren't ever super high earners. I think combined, maybe we hit 80. Like, we kind of like worked quote unquote normal jobs. Like, I worked at Starbucks and REI and I sold mattresses and furniture and all sorts of stuff. But yeah, saved half of our income, bought rentals, invested in the stock market, kept our expenses pretty low. And I was fired by the time I was 32, which was a decade ago, left the traditional work and have just been kind of doing my own thing, whatever I want, since then.
Love it. I like that a lot. And you have a book coming out. We actually reference it in the interview with JL. We talk mini retirements and hear about the new version of his book, but we do talk about your book. So can you just give people a little sneak peek? You can't get it yet, but you could pre-order. I have a couple pre-order copies coming my way, but let us know about the book so people know what to expect.
So it's called Retire Often, and it's essentially the system of how do you not just take one mini retirement, but how do you build this into your career? How do you create this entire lifestyle around taking these career breaks to focus on other things that really matter to you, focus on your other parts of your life? And I almost think about them as like a capital investment. You're investing a bunch of time and energy upfront into your health or your family or your hobbies or your experiences that will then continue to pay dividends throughout the rest of your life. And so it kind of just walks through the four steps of planning that time off so it's effective, all of the financial pieces, all of the career pieces, and what to expect on the journey that, in my perspective, you know, I've walked hundreds of people through this process. It's really familiar to me, but sometimes if people are going through it for the first or second time and they don't know a ton of people who've done it, their experience can feel incredibly unique and they might not see those challenges coming. But from where I sit, I'm like, oh yeah, no, that totally happens. That's simple. Like, here's how we fix that.
Yeah. And we had a great interview with JL, and I appreciate you coming on the show and helping me out today. And we talk about JL's mini retirements that he took through his career and some funny stories. He's a great storyteller. And we kind of weave in and out from the topics of Simple Path to Wealth and Retire Often. So fun conversation. And anything else that you observed during the interview today that people should look out for?
I love JL. He is amazing. And he has such a cool career trajectory. He was doing something so unique at the time, but something that worked great for him and had a great outcome. But I think he's a unique voice in the space because he's kind of like our dad or like our grandpa. Like, he's the one who's been talking about this with such level-headed wisdom for so long that I think it's helpful to, I think he's almost like the one that can give us permission to be like, you know what? Like, you've built some financial freedom. You can use that. You can leverage that. Like, you're saving all this money to make your life better. Like, it's okay if you make your life better, which sometimes on that path to FI, it's helpful to have those people that can encourage you. Like, you're not doing something wrong by enjoying your life.
It was a really fun interview. We'll put links in the show notes so you can get to Jillian's site, JL's book, all that kind of stuff. And let's get to the interview now. It's Doug from the future. And I think I just said we're going to send it to the episode in the interview, but I'm breaking one of the rules and I'm keeping you from that. But I want to give you a little update. We have ended the partnership with Ghostbed. Ghostbed's great, but it was time to move on. So they decided not to advertise here anymore, which is totally okay. That we had a great relationship over the past couple years, but basically we don't have any sponsors on the show now. And I remembered back when Carl and I started the show, we were like, if we can, we don't want to have ads on the show. Like, we're open to it if there was a right partnership, which in the case of Ghostbed, it was cool. It was hands off. Rich was our contact over there, listener of the show, and it was really cool to work with Ghostbed. But at this point in time, there's no sponsors out there, and there are other ways to like monetize the show. I know some of my friends, they actually have credit card affiliate partnerships or other partnerships that are they're well integrated. So it's like if they're, you know, credit card referrals can help the listeners out, it's like a win-win situation. And that's kind of what I want to have, because in the last couple of weeks, I've listened to some shows, some of which are, you know, the hosts are my friends. So I'm checking out their shows and I hear the ads and I'm like, why are they advertising that product? That sounds incongruent with the brand. And I don't want that to happen. There's some products that I do use. And if, you know, a company wanted to sponsor us and it was a product that I use, we could figure it out. I do like the hands-off stuff. That said, one of the ways a podcast can monetize is through essentially affiliate partnerships. Like, I'm wearing a Nectarine t-shirt. And if you need, for example, like fee-only advisors on an hourly basis, Nectarine is a great place to go check it out. So my hope is I'll be able to make this work with some affiliate suggestions. Another thing is Zero Shoes. That's X-E-R-O. These are wide toe box, zero drop, non-elevated heels. My friend told me about them. I checked them out and then ended up buying two pairs within the week. Turns out it's a Colorado company and they have awesome shoes. I literally bought two pairs like a year ago, and other shoes of mine that were wearing out. So I bought two more. So now I basically can just wear these zero drop shoes and you can't see them, but I'm wearing them right now. I work out in them, I hike in them, and I have other shoes too, but they're great shoes. So my hope is I'll be able to make suggestions for products that I actually use. Those are two of them. And you can actually head over to milehighfi.com/support and see other products that I do recommend, stuff that you're going to buy anyway. Chili pad is another thing that I absolutely love. And I think typically you could save like 10 to 15% if you use the coupon code. So it's just something to look at. If you haven't switched over to Mint Mobile, it's something that you could also check out. So I'll slowly try to figure this out. Like I said, my hope is not to have to get advertisers, and definitely not advertising like products that I don't like or use, or where you're like scratching your head thinking, why is Doug advertising for whatever student loan debt relief consolidation thing that doesn't make sense because it sounds scammy? Not that all of them are. I mean, some of those are probably fine. I just wanted to give you an update. If you want to help support the show, that's a great way to do it, buying things that you're going to buy anyway or products that I recommend. Alternatively, if you just want to do a straight up donation, that is cool. There's a Buy Me a Coffee. And then for the people out there who are thinking, hey, aren't you supposed to be retired and you don't like need to earn money and all that stuff? It's a great question. I'm glad you asked. The thing is, it does cost some money to run the show. Like, there's hosting. It turns out software was a fairly expensive piece of the puzzle here. It's not super cheap, and it makes it much easier to put like timestamps in and pull clips and that sort of thing. So software is actually a fairly expensive piece of the puzzle. And then you have hosting. All that said, I would love to just cover the cost to go to events like, you know, the economy ticket or to go to FinCon and that sort of thing. So really that's the idea. So it's not that I'm trying to get rich. I'm not getting rich from this, just trying to cover the cost and have a reason to like show up and do a good job. Because at the end of the day, if there's nothing but the enjoyment that I get from interviewing my friends, well, I don't necessarily have to make it as complicated as we do when we're trying to run a show. So I think I'm going deep in the weeds. Thank you for listening. A lot of you all probably fast forwarded through that, but that's the reality of like running these shows. It's, you know, it takes time. It takes money. There's coordination between me and Chris, the producer, for example. And then there's other coordination potentially like with JL's assistant for this interview. We have to schedule stuff and there's emails going back and forth. And I really don't want to put an extra piece of complexity working with like multiple advertisers where I have to send invoices and they're popping in and they're like, why do you keep talking about asparagus, you maniac? So thank you for listening to the show. I really do enjoy doing it. I enjoy talking to my friends. And now we will actually send it to the interview with JL Collins. All right, we're on. So let's get going. Jillian, you could kick it off.
So I'm curious, you know, your original version of The Simple Path to Wealth is getting updated. And you and I had talked, Jill, on my podcast about your mini retirements. And I think this is something maybe not as intuitive, like taking career breaks on this simple path to wealth. And yet it's something that you did frequently. So I would love to just hear a little bit more about that.
To start at the beginning, when I was walking this path, I had no concept of financial independence, right? I didn't actually come across that term until after I started my blog in 2011. The term I had in mind was FU money, which I picked up from a James Clavell novel. That concept immediately resonated with me. In my mind, FU money is not enough to retire and never work again, but enough to make bolder choices. And some of those bolder choices were taking the mini retirements that you just referred to. So in many ways, being on the simple path to wealth, which is a process of accumulating that FU money that ultimately leads to being fully FI, one of the benefits is it opens up the door to comfortably taking those mini retirements. And I used to say, I always loved working. You know, I loved my professional career. I just didn't want to do it all the time. So it was great stepping away from it.
What was your career? Did you switch around and do different stuff? Because most people in our community, they know your book and they've listened to some interviews, but what right. did you do?
That's an interesting trend, by the way. When I look at my father's generation, if you were fortunate, in those days, you got out of college, you joined some corporation, and you were there for the next 40 years, and you retired with your gold watch and a pension. For my generation, I was in the magazine business, so in business-to-business magazines, trade magazines. And I think like a lot of people of my generation, that was the one industry I was in, but I job hopped between different magazine publishers. People would reach out and make offers that were more lucrative than I was being paid wherever I was. And if it looked good on other scores, then I would move on. So that was kind of the career path for my generation. One industry, but multiple companies. What I think I see in the younger generations is multiple companies and multiple industries. They work in one area for a while and then seamlessly, easily seem to switch into another industry and obviously with different companies. To me, I always thought my career was much more interesting than those of the generation before me because I got to experience all these different companies and businesses. But it seems to me that the newer way of doing things where you get to experience not only different companies, but wholly different industries, you get to reinvent yourself on a regular basis, which, by the way, is a great use of mini retirements. That just seems to me to be ideal. And then, of course, you blend in the option. You know, I spent decades figuring out the simple path to wealth. It took me a long time. But if you look at somebody like my daughter, who knew about it from the beginning, it's, you know, if you have an adequate savings rate, it's about a 10-15 year journey, and then you're financially independent. And that point, you can really do anything you want.
I think that's a big concern, especially in the Phi Fire community. If I take these career breaks, if I, you know, have these little pockets of life that I really enjoy and do cool things, is that going to postpone when I become financially independent? Is that going to postpone my actual early retirement? And, you know, I wonder what that looked like on your path, and is it still worth it?
Yeah. So again, I didn't have this concept of financial independence and early retirement, right? And I frequently think, Jillian, to myself, if I did, would early retirement have been a goal? And I kind of don't think so. I wrote a post early on for Mr. Money Mustache called "It's Never Been About Retirement for Me." But I think one of the reasons that it wasn't about retirement for me is I did take these mini retirements. So I wasn't burning myself out by working for 40 consecutive years, which I think would be kind of an awful thing to do. So clearly, if you step away and you stop earning income for some period of time, then, you know, it's going to derail your investments as you go along and what have you, and it might stretch out your journey a bit. But the whole goal isn't necessarily to get to a final FI number in my mind, although you can make that your goal if you like. Money facilitates the best possible life. And if you have enough FU money to take those mini retirements, then that seems to me to be a pretty cool way to live your life. And if it takes you a little longer to get to that ultimate FI goal, then I certainly would have been content with that. But again, it wasn't really an issue for me because I didn't even have the concept in my head.
I think you're also at a point in your life where you have a really unique and important perspective. And, you know, kind of when we were first chatting, you mentioned like you're not so keen on travel anymore. And right. I think we underestimate as we age how our preferences and the things that we're excited about will shift. And I know during your mini retirements, like you did a lot of really cool travel, but now being at the point you are now, looking back, I just wonder how much you appreciate doing that in that season of your life versus being like, well, I could have just saved all that till I was 65.
I really am grateful that I did it when I did it, because a lot of things that I did when I was younger, I would not want to do now. I mean, the first mini retirement I took was for 6 weeks, and I spent that a month in Ireland riding my bicycle around, and then a week in Wales, and then I met my girlfriend at the time in London for the final week. You know, and I'm in rural Ireland, sometimes sleeping on the ground, and that was great. I mean, I loved it. I used to, in my 20s, backpack and go out in the wilderness somewhere, and, you know, I didn't even take a tent. You know, and if I got wet, I got wet. That was great then. I mean, I loved it. Now I want to have luxury hotels with mints on my pillow, right? I'm old and soft. So yeah, there would be no, for me at least, there'd be no long distance bicycle trips or sleeping on the ground at this point. I think I was 50 the last time I was out sleeping on the ground. And even then I was thinking, you know, this is pushing the envelope. So I think there are certain things that you want to do at certain points of your life. I mean, going on a luxury cruise, for instance, in your 20s just doesn't make any sense to me at all. I mean, that doesn't sound like any fun. In fact, I'm not a huge fan of cruising even now, but it certainly has. I was talking to a friend of mine who's going to go on one of these river cruises and asking him about it. And it does sound like something that didn't appeal to me before, but maybe fits into what I'm willing and capable of doing at this point. So yeah, I think it's important. That's another reason it's important to take these mini retirements so you can do some of that stuff at the right season of your life.
So you mentioned this 6 week mini retirement. How old were you then? How did you enable it? Were your peers doing that also? Can you just go a little bit deeper into it?
So to answer the last part of that question, no, nobody was doing that. That was one of the hardest things about this whole process, is because there was no internet in those days. So I didn't know anybody who thought the way I did in terms of saving a large portion of my income, living more modestly, investing it, and then stepping away from work. I mean, nobody. And that filled me with doubt a lot of the time. I mean, it didn't change me, to be clear. But I did. I did have some angst around it. Like, you know, why the hell am I doing this and nobody else? So the way it came about is I was probably about 25 years old. When I came out of college, it was a very bad economic time. This was in the 70s during stagflation and pretty ugly economic situation, and one that we might be in risk of going into now, but we haven't seen it since the 70s, thankfully. And anyway, it took me 2 years to get my first professional job, which was a magazine publisher. And I really liked that job. It was hard to come by, and I really liked it, and I was pretty good at it. But after a couple of years of doing it, I had accumulated the princely sum of $5,000. I was making $10,000 a year in those days. And $5,000, the way I could live, was more than enough to go and backpack around Europe for a year and come back and still have a financial cushion until I could find my next job. I really wanted to do that because, going back to Jillian's point, I mean, I was the right age to do it, but I really liked this job. There was no model for an alternative, so I agonized over this for a long time, debating whether I should quit my job, which seemed to be the only alternative, and go to Europe, or just give up on going to Europe and keep working. Meanwhile, I was reading books on traveling in Europe and looking at airfares, and I forget what airline it was, but one of them publicized a special airfare that was really cheap. And the only deal was you had to leave on a certain day and come back a certain day 4 months later. And I thought, well, that's not the year I want, but maybe the company would let me go for that 4 months. So, and this was a small company, and I reported directly to the president of the company. His name was Carl, a nice old guy, and although probably younger than I am today, but in those days, he was an old guy. And so I went into Carl's office one day, and I sat down across from him. I proposed that I leave for 4 months and then come back. And I mean, I didn't even know to call it a mini retirement or a sabbatical, or I had no idea what to call this. And he looked at me like I had two heads. And I mean, he was kind of stunned. Clearly, this was beyond the pale of anything he'd experienced with any employee in his life. And he said, no. He said, no, you can't do that. No. I didn't realize at that point things could be negotiated, right? And so I said, okay, well, you know, thank you for listening. And I went back to my office, and I'm thinking, well, you know, now I'm back to my original dilemma. Do I blow off Europe and keep working at this job I do love, or do I blow off this job and go to Europe? And I agonized for about a week and decided I want to go to Europe. Anyway, a week later, I went back into Carl's office and I resigned. You know, they liked me. I liked them. They knew I was happy. And he said, why are you resigning? And I said, well, I really want to go to Europe for a year. And he said, this amazed me. This was not some negotiating ploy on my part. And he said, well, don't do anything rash. Let me go talk to the owner of the company. And I said, okay. A couple of days later, he called me back into his office and he said, tell you what, if you can guarantee that you will be back on that certain day 4 months from now, we will hold your job for you. We'd prefer you just take a month, and then we'll give you a month's vacation every year. In those days, the maximum you could get was 2 weeks, at least with this company. So that was a pretty good deal. But while I didn't know that negotiating was possible when I started this, I'm not entirely stupid. So I said, well, that sounds good. But how about 6 weeks for the first year? And he said, done. The next thing I knew, I was putting my bicycle on the airplane and flying to Shannon Airport.
That is a great story. I'm glad you went into the detail. Why do you think you had the cojones to ask for that? You were just young and you were like, hey, I'll just give it a shot. I want to do this.
Well, I appreciate the compliment. I've never thought of it as having a cojones, I can't even say it, balls, to do it.
There you go, yeah.
I guess I did, but But as I reflect on the question, I think it's because I was living modestly, again, on half my salary, and I had, you know, I had this money put aside that I didn't realize it gave me negotiating leverage, but I knew it gave me leverage to go off and do something. I guess I was young and arrogant enough to think, hey, well, I got this job. When I come back, I'll get another job. It didn't seem like an extraordinary thing to me. I was aware that nobody else was doing this. And one of the challenges, by the way, because I did this multiple times throughout my career, I would, because you get addicted to it. I mean, you know, once you get to step away for 6 weeks, you want more. And the big challenge in those days, because it was so unheard of, I think nowadays, if you went into an interview and you'd been away from work for an extended period of time and they said, well, you know, what did you do while you were gone? You said something, well, I rode my bicycle around Ireland. The interviewer would probably be, well, I want to hear more about this. In my day, if you said that, the interview would be, oh, well, thank you very much, Mr. Collins. Next. You know, so I had to figure out creative ways to fill those gaps in my resume. I never told prospective employers about this history of leaving to go play.
Do you think it was helpful on the simple path to wealth to, you know, you're doing all the right things. You're earning enough money, you're living modestly, you're investing. Were these breaks, although, you know, they cost money, you're not earning money.
Right.
Do you think it kind of was helpful to maintain that motivation because you had something, this really tangible reward to kind of look forward to?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm the kind of person, and I hope this doesn't sound like a humble brag because I don't mean it that way, but when I work very, very intensely because I really do like to work. The problem with that is that you can't do it for 40 years. And what it took me a while to figure out is I could do that for about 4 years. And of course, because I did that, employers tended to love me because that leads to pretty great performance. But then coming towards the end of that 4 year period, I'd be burning out and I would be less and less effective. And it would take me a while to recognize that. Fortunately, it would take my employers a while to recognize that because you have a certain amount of momentum going. But ultimately, I came to the conclusion, if they weren't smart enough to get rid of me after 4 years, I had to be smart enough to step away on my own. You know, and to be clear, sometimes it was less than that. Sometimes it was a few years more. But I discovered there was a pattern. And that was distinctly different because people who are in it the way my dad was for like 40 years, I mean, you've got to pace yourself. You can't do what I was doing. You just have to pace yourself. And that's what I saw most people around me doing. And it's kind of the hare and the tortoise story where, you know, the tortoise ultimately wins the race. Even though the hare is a lot faster. Well, you know, I was kind of the hare. I'd go racing down the track, and then I'd sit around for months or sometimes years at a time, you know, while the tortoises went past me. So,
Jillian, you help people take mini retirements and some of the negotiation pieces. So we heard JL's story here. Do you have any observations on either how things are similar to what JL did nowadays or how they're different? And I'll kind of give you leeway. Just I'm curious what you think of that, just because people weren't doing it in the mid-70s through the 90s or so, you know, through the many, many retirements you took, JL. So what do you think, Jillian?
I think what JL did is like kind of the perfect model in a couple ways. One, you know, my book coming out is Retire Often, and I talk about like thinking through your capability and your financial freedom, like in kind of a grid matrix. And when you're younger, doing things that require more capability, more physical capability, but are more affordable, like front load that stuff in your life, because in your 60s, 70s, 80s, you can do things that require less or require more money because you've earned more money, you've accumulated more money, but require less capability, like a luxury cruise. There's a lot of 80-year-olds on luxury cruises and they got the cash for it. So it's like better timing. But also this idea of like working super hard and taking breaks. sometimes there's this misconception that like mini retirements are for lazy people. And I find the people who enjoy them the most, who benefit the most, are high performers because they have that cadence of like, they like to run fast. It's kind of like HIIT training. They like to run fast and then they like to walk and then they like to run fast and then they like to walk. It's how they enjoy working. It's very rewarding for them. So I think that model is great. And thankfully, a lot of people are doing it and a lot of people are recognizing it. So it's not uncommon now. And even in high performance careers, I think there's this understanding of like, if you're going to push at that 100, 110%, you're probably going to need a break. So if someone sees, you know, a 2 month, 3 month, 6 month gap in your resume, and you say, hey, worked super hard in the last job. I've just spent the last 6 months recovering. I did all this cool stuff. I feel 100% now. Like I'm ready to push hard for the next 2 or 3 or 5 years. It's kind of like, oh, thank goodness. Like you don't want to hire burned out people. And if you're a sprinter, like you're gonna, there's a wall, you hit a wall. So I think it's not only more accepted, but it's kind of, it's an advantage. Like high performance players take breaks. Like that's how you perform at your maximum capacity is you get periods of rest.
Back in the day when I was doing this, I had nobody to tell me that. I just felt like I was doing everything wrong and I was certainly doing everything different. And Jillian was nice enough to send me the manuscript of her upcoming book. And I love this. Because it not only gives you permission to do this stuff, it tells you how to do it strategically, and tells you how to present it as an advantage, as Jillian was just talking about, to your employers. It's just brilliant. I read this book and I think, I should have written this book. But even though I did this, I'm just stunned, Jillian, at the depth of wisdom and ideas you have around this subject and that you've put into this book, because even though this is how I lived out my 40-year career, I still read this book and said, wow, this is amazing. This is information that now when I'm fully retired, I don't need, but man, it's so good. It's so insightful. And I'm thrilled for people that it's become more common today. And I think it is, especially if you frame it as, you know, I'm now recharged because I took this 6 months off and this is a cool thing that I did. You know, the people interviewing you, by and large, I would guess, are going to say, wow, tell me more. I want to hear about this. This sounds like something I'd like to do. You know, I sure wish I could ride my bicycle around Europe or go on a safari or whatever it is that you spent your sabbatical doing.
There's also a lot of good personality characteristics to people who pull this off. Like, one, you have to be courageous, kind of like Doug was mentioning. You have to be a little bit creative, but you have to be disciplined. You have to have forethought. You have to be motivated. Like, you have to be organized. It's a real tough thing to wing if, like, you've never saved any money or, like, you don't have any passions. Like it kind of indicates you have all these other great qualities to be able to do something like this that are all going to be beneficial for that next company you work for.
Boy, I wish somebody had told me that 40 years ago. Where were you 40, 50 years ago? Oh, yes. You were just a concept in the ether at that point. I get it.
I don't even know if I was a concept.
Yeah, right. I agree with both of y'all, what you were saying there. I will mention for people that are not high performers like myself, you also need breaks and it's totally cool to take breaks because I know there is a lot of emphasis on like, oh yeah, if you're the top 10% or whatever, just again, high performer. But even if you're not, you need breaks too. So it's all still valid. Yes. Well, and Jay, so you've taken a handful of these mini retirements. Is there anything that you would have changed in hindsight or just recommendations for other people that might be doing this, you know, in the next couple of few years?
Yeah, I don't know that there's anything I particularly would have changed, but if I'd had access to Jillian's book, which I highly recommend to anybody who's thinking about doing this, if I'd had access to that book, I would have had I would have been much more comfortable in doing it. And I would have been much more skilled and savvy in presenting it to the employer I was leaving, because sometimes you can leave that door open to come back. And in presenting it to the future employers, in this day and age, I think I would be bolder about having it on my resume, which, as they say, when I was doing it, you know, I had to figure out, okay, how do I explain not having a job for 5 years, you know, in a way that's acceptable in the world I live in. So, yeah, I think I did it fairly well, but it was uncomfortable. And I think if I'd had Jillian's book, it would have been a much more comfortable process. And part of that comfort would have come from just having a better knowledge base and being more skilled and polished in pulling it off than I was. Because I was just kind of inventing this as I went along.
You know, you've outlined and now revised this simple path to wealth. How do you see mini retirements fitting in with that into kind of along the path, the financial, but also this lifestyle piece?
Yeah, so I don't actually talk about mini retirements in my book. But what I do talk about is that if you get this money stuff right, if you're following the simple path, it really is simple. You need to understand a couple of basic concepts, and you need to implement a couple of basic investment strategies and put them on autopilot, and then you're done. That begins to build your wealth. And the whole point in building your wealth, as I say on the tagline of the book, is to have a rich, free life. However you define having a rich, free life. For me, it was taking the mini retirements, which very largely revolved around extended travel. Traveling for 4, 6, you know, 12 months at a time is a very different experience than going on a 2-week vacation, right? I mean, people joke that they go on their 2-week vacation and then they need a vacation when they get back to work because they're exhausted. The other thing that was striking to me about, especially some of my longer sabbaticals, was the serendipity that falls into your lap, because, you know, you're out and about, you're meeting people you wouldn't meet otherwise. Sometimes opportunities you never would have come across are presented to you, including, you know, job possibilities. It's, you know, not only is it R&R and recharging your batteries and having fun, but it has the potential to just create whole new avenues of opportunity for you, especially, I think, in today's economy, where, as I was saying earlier, I think people have an opportunity not just to go from company to company, but from entirely different industries. And so when you're out and traveling around and you tend to meet really interesting people when you're doing that. And you might have mutual interests with those people, and they might have interesting ideas and opportunities for you, and vice versa, by the way.
One of the things that I find perplexing sometimes in the FI community, you know, you talk about FU money, we are building financial freedom. And yet sometimes the people who have, quote unquote, the most financial freedom seem the least free. They seem the most enslaved to their savings rate, to their FI number, which isn't really FU money at all. It's like serving a sentence, you know, until right. You get to this. When people are on this simple path to wealth and they're trying to build this financial freedom, I think if you have any encouragement, I think you are the perfect person in the FI community. If someone needed permission to use this financial freedom that they've created, permission to use this FU money, I think you might be the person to give it to them. Like, what encouragement would you have for them?
You know, Jillian, you raise a really important point, I think, and one that is a little bit overlooked. I mean, there's a lot of talk now about spending money, right? But what you're raising is a little bit different, it seems to me, and this idea that your money becomes your master rather than your servant. It's driven around fear, right? And people accumulate sometimes really large amounts of money, and they're fearful about spending it, enjoying it, using it. One of the things that I did in the new edition of The Simple Path to Wealth is I included probably my single favorite case study. I used to do case studies on a regular basis. The title of the study is What It Looks Like When Everything Financial Goes Wrong. Tom was a client of mine, actually. He was an advertising agency exec. That's how I got to know him, and we became friends. But Tom wound up at the age of 62. He'd been married multiple times. So he had a couple of divorces. He had, I don't know, four or five kids. The advertising business prefers youth. So Tom wound up at the age of 62, unemployed, with no prospects because nobody wanted the 62-year-old advertising executive. He'd burned through what little savings he'd had. He went bankrupt. He lost his house to foreclosure. He lost, in the bankruptcy, everything, except he had a collection of antique guns, which he persuaded the judge to let him keep. That was the only thing, the only asset he came out. At the age of 62, he had a small pension from one of the companies he'd worked for, because like me, he'd worked at multiple different companies, but one of them he'd worked long enough to get a small pension. Took his Social Security at 62, which you can do. It's not optimal because your check is going to be lower, but if you got to have the money, you got to have the money. And then Tom found a job in the Detroit area. There's the Henry Ford Museum, I want to say in Dearborn, that has an operating farm from like the 1800s. It's how, you know, it's an actual operating farm with animals and crops. But they do it all in the way it was done in the 1800s. And they have actors, basically, who are doing real farm work. But they're dressed in period clothing, and part of their job is to talk to the tourists who've come to look at that. And that's what Tom does now. So he's got this physical job. He's out in the fresh air. He's really good at it. He's got exactly the right look for it. And he just absolutely loves it. Now recovered enough that he's bought a very modest house in, again, the Detroit area. He's got a girlfriend. They just celebrated a three-year anniversary. Tom is probably the least financially successful person I know. He's probably also the single happiest person I have ever met in my life through all of this trauma. And the reason, so that's the reason I like this case study so much, is because money isn't everything. You know, attitude makes such a difference. I mean, why does Tom have this pretty cool job? Well, because Tom's the kind of guy you want to have around, right? Especially in that environment. Why does Tom have no problem having a girlfriend? Well, because Tom's the kind of guy you want to be around, and women are attracted to that. Tom's got a very close group of friends, including me. Why? Well, because that's who Tom is, and none of this has anything to do with money. And so when I come across people who have multiple millions of dollars saved and invested, and God bless you, I mean, that's the goal that my book talks about achieving. Great, but when you're spending all your time worried about losing it, that's not so great. And I'm trying to illustrate that even if that were to happen, and by the way, that's highly unlikely for the people in the CEFI community who are reading my book and implementing, the fact that you're going to wind up like Tom is, odds are infinitesimally small. But even if you do, here's a guy who's, just because he's got the right attitude, still is living a, it's not a wealthy life, but it's a great life. It's a life that most people, including me, look at with envy. And in a way that I don't look at Elon Musk's life with envy, or even Jeff Bezos's life with envy. But I do look at Tom and I say, man, you know, maybe he's got it figured out.
So I have the new version of the book right here. And I'm curious, what was the motivation to update the book?
That wasn't actually my original plan. You know, a little more than a year ago, I started thinking about what I was going to do with this asset, and particularly thinking about my daughter, right? And again, she's been on the simple path to wealth, but as far as I could tell, she was executing it because it's simple. So what occurred to me was maybe, like I've seen some musicians do, because I have three books out, I would sell the package, right? Basically selling the cash flow from the royalties. And then I would take that lump sum and invest it in, of course, if you're me, VTSAX. And that would be a simpler, cleaner thing to leave to my heirs. So I found a an agent. I asked around to some of my published friends who their agent was and if they liked them. And I interviewed a couple of agents and I explained to them what I wanted to do. They all said, I've never heard of that before. And that was the end of those conversations. And when I got to Molly and I explained it to her, Molly said, I've never heard of that before, but that's kind of interesting. I wonder what we could do with that. And what Molly did with it is she put together a little offering package and sent it out to five publishers with the idea of selling these rights. And one declined to participate. Three of the remaining four came back with cash offers, only one of which was even close. But the fourth one came back and said, you know, we don't want to do that, but we'd love to publish an updated edition of the book. And while I was going through this process, I engaged my daughter, Jessica, because as I said to her, you know, Jess, whatever I decide here is going to affect me for maybe a decade. It's going to affect you for the next half century, maybe more, right? So you should pay attention here. So she was looking at all these offers and suggestions with me, and I was resistant to the idea of going with a publisher because that just wasn't what I had in my mind. To my amazement, she said, you know, I think that's where we ought to go. I think that's what I would like to see. And I said, well, you know, that means that you're going to be stuck with this book for the rest of your life. And that's what I was trying to avoid for you. And she said, no, I want to continue to be involved with the book and your legacy. So that's how I wound up choosing this particular path. As the publisher, they were the ones who wanted to do the updated edition, which I thought that makes sense if we're going to do this, because there are some things I wanted to do differently. Not differently, but in addition, because the basic path is unchanged. The basic philosophy is the same. But editions like Tom's story were an important thing for me to add. But what was really gratifying is that Jessica became very involved in the editing and updating process. And so she and I got to work very closely on this. And what I learned was that she had a much deeper understanding of the work than I ever dreamed. Mm-hmm. And of course, that was enormously gratifying to me. So it was a very cool thing, but that's kind of how we got here.
Wow. That was not the answer I expected. That's awesome.
Wasn't the answer I expected either when I started on this journey.
Yeah. Well, I love the idea of like selling the rights and all that kind of stuff. And right. Obviously, like it took a different turn, but yeah, very, pretty novel approach and interesting. Yeah. Does Jessica do interviews? I'll have to follow up with you later, maybe in a few months or something like that.
She has done, I'm trying to remember, one or two with me where people have asked if she would do it. I don't think she has a great enthusiasm for it, but she does, you know, she does do it. And, you know, you would have to ask her, and I'd be happy to facilitate that. But,
all right.
Yeah. People are curious about her because, of course, she's the whole motivation for Jessica likes to tease me. Because the whole reason I started putting this stuff down on paper was because I turned her off to all things financial and she wouldn't listen to me. And I came to think of her as the little girl who wouldn't listen. And she says to me now, she says, you know, Dad, if I'd listened to you when I was young, there would be no blog. There would have been no Chautauquas. There would be no books. And Jillian and Doug would have no interest in talking to you. And and she's right. You know, so I owe it all to the little girl who wouldn't listen. And to my great satisfaction, she actually did listen and is well on her way to her own journey.
Super cool. So. The biggest surprise here is in the new edition, you're a big proponent of Bitcoin now. So I was shocked with that.
Yeah, a number of years ago, I sold everything and went into Bitcoin. And, you know, I figured it was about time to let people know that. Obviously, we're all laughing, so I hope nobody took that last comment seriously. I do. There, one of the things in the book is an FAQ that's new. The FAQ allowed me to answer a lot of questions that I didn't think necessarily fit in the body of the book. And one of those, of course, which I have gotten a lot over the years, is what do you think of cryptocurrencies? In short, what I think of them, is, obviously, mean, I wish 10, 15 years ago I had sold everything and gone in crypto because I'd be a billionaire. But you didn't know that at that point. You have no idea where it's going now or any place along that journey. So I don't regret not having done it because it's not part of my discipline. Crypto, in my mind, it's way too volatile to actually serve as a currency. Currencies require some stability to function as a means of facilitating trade, buying and selling goods. So they really are very ineffective, other than, I guess, if you're in criminal activities, they're useful. So they're really a speculation. It's kind of like buying gold. You know, you buy gold hoping that at some point in the future, somebody will pay you more for your gold than you paid for it. And it's the same thing with crypto. You know, you buy it hoping that at some point in the future, somebody will pay you more. And so far, that's worked out pretty well. But that doesn't mean, like any speculation, it's going to continue to work out. I'm not a speculator. I'm an investor. And the difference is that when I buy investments, I'm buying pieces of actual operating companies that are creating services and products that they sell and market. And if they do it effectively, they have money left over after their expenses are paid that is called profit, that as an owner, I can benefit from. And that is how wealth is generated rather than speculation. So I own wealth generators, if you will, and that's what investors do when they hold them for the long term. So that therein lies the difference, which is why I don't invest in gold and I don't invest in crypto. And yeah, sometimes those things turn out amazingly well. There's an awful lot of things like that that have turned out terribly. So ask me how I know.
Well, Jill, you might appreciate this. I, a while back, I was having a drink with a gentleman and he starts trying to like tell me how awesome Bitcoin is. And I was like, well, I mean, I feel like it's more speculative than it's really an investment. And then he just goes off on all the reasons he loves crypto and how I'm wrong, how it's really an investment. It's not speculative. And I just lean in and I go, is this the hill you want to die on with me? And he was like, oh, wait, no. Change the subject.
Did you say that?
Yep.
Oh.
Yeah, he did not realize how sideways he was taking this drink together by lecturing me on crypto as an investment and not speculative. So,
well, you know, it's like a lot of these meme stocks are the same kind of thing. There's a lot of true believers in these things, and that's, you know, one of the ways that they can get driven higher, but you know, sometimes the merry-go-round stops, and it doesn't necessarily let you know when it's going to stop. The other comment I'll make about this, by the way, is because there have been cases, as I said earlier, I mean, Bitcoin has worked out marvelously well for people who particularly got into it early, and it's created great wealth in some cases in a hurry. The problem with wealth created in a hurry is that it tends not to be sticky wealth. Right. You see the same thing when people win lotteries. You know, the percentage of lottery winners who wind up bankrupt in a fairly short period of time is kind of appalling. They typically don't know how to handle wealth. And when it comes your way easily, it's just too easy to dissipate it. And when it comes to your way by investing in something like a crypto, it's way too easy to confuse your great good luck with great skill. And that means that you wind up slowly but surely giving it back. This is the same principle, by the way, that casinos work on. Right? If you've ever been in a casino, you will notice that people are winning all the time. The casino, I think, pays back something like 96% of every dollar that's bet. They want people winning, but that last 4% means that ultimately they wind up with everything over time. So somebody wins big and they celebrate and, you know, maybe they buy stuff in the casino stores, but typically they slowly but surely give it back into the games. I have a good friend of mine who a couple of years ago, I want to say 3, maybe 4 years ago now, placed a weird bet on the Kentucky Derby and he won $300,000.
Oh my gosh. Right?
I mean, just an unbelievable amount of money. that's great. And he was very excited about it. And I keep talking to him and teasing him a little bit. And he is slowly but surely giving it back. So every year with the Kentucky Derby runs, as it just did recently. So how much did you win this year? Yeah, I lost a bunch. So there's a psychology that makes it not impossible, but very difficult to hang on to quickly gained wealth. It's just not as sticky as the wealth that you build over the years.
I think that's such an unpopular, disappointing thought process to a lot of people starting out. But I would be curious, in this concept of the simple path to wealth, yes, part of it is a system, but what percentage is just the consistency to work the system over long periods of time in building wealth?
I think that's a great point. So basic way you invest in the simple path to wealth is broad-based, low-cost index funds, right? And my preference is VTSAX, which is Vanguard's Total Stock Market Index Fund. VTI is the ETF version of it. It's the same portfolio. It's the same thing. I get a question all the time as well, is it okay if I'm in VTI? And that tells me, first of all, you don't really understand what you're investing in because you don't know that it's the same portfolio. So step one is maybe understand that better. But absolutely, go ahead and do it. And then the other question I get is, I prefer Fidelity over Vanguard, and Fidelity has a total stock market fund. Is that okay? Well, yes. I mean, these are not the things to worry about. The thing to worry about is you want a broad-based, low-cost fund. An S&P 500 fund fits that bill. The S&P 500 make up about 80% of VTSAX. If you track their performance over time, the lines on a graph, the lines very closely match. The only reason I prefer a total stock market fund is, as I say, the same reason I like a little Tabasco on my eggs. It's just a little extra spice with some small caps. But fundamentally, any of these things, if you are consistent and stay the course, don't panic and sell when the market goes down, they will work well. Agonizing whether you want an S&P 500 or a total stock market, or you want it from Vanguard, it's the wrong place to put your energies. The right place to put your energy is to avoid the speculative stuff, avoid trying to pick individual stocks and actively manage funds. Pick one of those basics, and it really doesn't matter which one, and keep adding to it. Come hell or high water and stay the course. You look at Warren Buffett. And I don't mean in this comment to take anything away from his investing acumen, because obviously he's a master. He's just done phenomenally well. But if you track his wealth, and I don't remember it exactly off the top of my head, it's like my wealth, only much bigger numbers, in that it's very, very slow growth, and then it hockey sticks. And that's the power of compounding. That's the power of consistency. Part of the success of Warren Buffett is he buys things and holds them for the long term. He doesn't dance in and out of them. He never panics and sells when the market goes down. When the market crashed in 08, 09, Buffett lost, I want to say it was $60 billion, lost. And I put that in quote marks because his investment value, as everybody's did in those days, went down by 50% or whatever it was. But he didn't lose it because he didn't panic and sell. He stayed the course. And of course, like it did for everybody, it came back and then some, continued to grow. That's part of his secret. Buffett is famous for saying, rule number one is don't lose the money. Rule number two is don't forget rule number one. But people, I think, misunderstand what he's saying there, because they think, don't lose the money means he can anticipate when the market's going to crash and step to the side and then know when the crash is over and step back in. That's not what he does. In fact, he also has said, referring to the last century, the 20th century, and the beginning of the century, the market was something like 600, and it ended the century at 12,000. He goes on to say, how do you lose in a market that does that? But the truth is, most people did. And he goes on to say, you lose by trying to dance in and out. So when Buffett says rule number one is don't lose the money, what he's really saying is don't panic and sell when the market goes down, because he doesn't do that. And that's another key reason that he's gotten to where he is. So yeah, consistency and holding for the long term is the magic formula.
JL, this is awesome. It's always good to catch up. Very excited that you have the new revision out there. Where's the best place for people to get this?
It will be on May 20th. As the saying goes, it will be available wherever books are sold. That's one of the advantages of having a publisher as opposed to self-publishing, by the way. You can find it on Amazon, which is where you could always find the original, but in everything from Barnes & Nobles to, I guess, individual bookstores scattered around the country. So it should be widely available. If worse comes to worse, you can always go to my blog, jlcollinsnh.com, and there'll be a place where you can click on it, click on the book, and order it there.
Very good. Awesome. Well, like I said, always good to catch up. We'll put links so people can find the book and get to your stuff and all that. And thanks, Jillian, for helping out too. Appreciate you both. Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. JL, you've been working hard, but I'm curious, do you have any trips coming up over the rest of the year, something like that, that you're looking forward to?
Yeah, I don't actually travel too much anymore. It's kind of lost its luster for me, but I am going to New York next week to do a little promotion on the book and a couple of interviews. And my wife, Jane, is going to meet me there. So yeah, it should be kind of fun. And I'm looking forward to seeing, my publishers are there, and I'll get to meet the team that I worked with for multiple months now face-to-face. And we're all getting together for dinner. It should be a lot of fun.
That's pretty fun. Yeah. And if I remember right, you live in a fairly quiet area. So is it a little system overload to be like right in New York City?
Yeah, I haven't been to New York in, a long, long time. And I've never particularly been a fan of the city. I'm a Chicago boy. In my world, Chicago is just the second city, but the better one. But no offense to my friends in New York. But yeah, New York is not my favorite place, but some of my favorite people are there. So
very good. Yeah. How about you, Jillian? Any trips coming up?
I try to stay in Montana in the summer because it is like pure magic air. So unless there's an emergency that takes me away, but come winter, yeah, I want to be scarce. I haven't decided exactly where I'm going, but I'm definitely leaving.
But not Montana.
Yeah.
Well, that makes total sense. Like Montana is the summer is the time to be there unless you're a winter sport person or something like that. But yeah, you got the long days. What time does the sun set? Because you're in the northern part of the state, right?
Yeah, very, very tippy top. I mean, it gets long. Like if you want to see the stars, you better stay up till like 11 or midnight because like the sun might go down, but it's just that real slow kind of alpine glow haze. So yeah, it's fun.
Yeah.
I bet during the winter, if you want to see the stars, you go out at 2 p.m, right?
It kind of feels that way. Just, yeah.
Where are you located, Doug?
I'm in Longmont, so close to Pete.
That's right. Yeah, the sort of FI Central.
Yeah, it's crazy. Like in the last year or two, like more people have like relocated. They check it out for a couple of weeks. Maybe they're around the area for the summer or Camp Fi down in Colorado Springs. So they'll swing by and see sort of the community and the fact that like there's a bunch of other early retirees around. And yeah, so they figured out how to relocate and hang out here, move, and it's pretty amazing.
I understand it's kind of driven your housing prices up considerably.
Yeah, like I guess nearly single-handedly, Pete got a bunch of people to move here, but it's good. Right. I mean, we're all benefiting. Yeah.
Does the town itself recognize this, or they just is it under their radar?
I think it's. You know what? I'm not sure. I think it's mostly under the radar. However, there have been HOA goings on, which I'll skip the details because no one wants to hear me complain. But in chatting with some folks, there is an awareness. Like people are like, oh yeah, I have heard of the FIRE movement. And oh yeah, there are some bloggers that are in town. So like if people kind of look around, they end up discovering it. But you know, these days it's like there's so many people that work from home, like it's kind of normal-ish to just have, you know, people not working or commuting and just people are just kind of home all the time. Although we're just around all the time and it's kind of clear we don't work. We're like walking the dog and like doing stuff. We're just always in the yard or outside. So yeah, people are like, what is this guy doing? Like, he's just constantly outside doing stuff. So anyway.
Yeah. The cafes are full at 10 in the morning. And
yeah. So, yeah, exactly.